White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. This is November 29th, and I'm Carolyn Yeager here with Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Well, Hadding, tonight we are going to be completing Chapter 18, which we started last week. And, you know, I keep saying that, oh, this is a great chapter, and I think we're into some very good stuff. And Chapter 18 is, Chapter 17 was very, very good, but the press and the power of the press. And now this chapter is called Does This Explain the Jewish World Program? And it's an attempt, I think, what they're doing here, an attempt to explain what this world program is as it's described in the protocols. A study finds that it is after, well, as they study it, what they put in, okay, what I'm doing now is I am going to do a little summary of what we talked about last week, okay? The first part of this chapter. It finds that after...
the title is, Does This Explain Jewish Political Power?
Oh, I got that. I copied that wrong. World power. Okay, thank you for that. Jewish political power. And so it calls it a world program. And, no, I already did that. Well, I'm confusing myself here. Okay, a study finds that what this political program is about, what it's after, is first it wants financial control of the world, then political control, and then control of education, and trivializing the mind of the common man, common Gentile man, via the introduction of allurements such as jazz. Remember, this is back in 1920. Now, you know, this business, jazz was something that Henry Ford particularly disliked. And I think this, to a lot of people, this might seem overly Puritan or dowdy, like, wow, gosh, don't be so weird to be against jazz. And I used to be a lover of jazz, but I do believe now that jazz does have a degrading effect on us. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. The objection to it, what used to be it puts such a heavy emphasis on rhythm. You know, I think a lot of jazz probably could be considered as, I honestly don't know a lot about it. I don't know a lot about it. I took a music theory course where the instructor was very keen on jazz, and he touched on it a little bit, and the theory of it seemed kind of interesting. You know, using different scales than the usual mm-hmm. scale. But I have to say, just from hearing it on the radio, you know, on NPR and so forth, a lot of it just sounds like a lot of, sonic doodling, you know, running up and down scales.
Yeah, that's what I've read about it.
More or less.
Yeah, that's right. And it's very sexually oriented. Or if it's not sexual, then it just kind of relaxes you into just not, you know, into a state of mind that's, or a way of thinking and being that's just not like what we are. And at back, you know, the idea of all this stuff was that we white people needed to expand ourselves and get into Negro music and this kind of music and something else. And other times it's been, you know, Indian music and so on. But, I think that our music is right for us, and I think now that jazz has a bad effect on young people. I think it had I don't know what kind of effect it had on me. But anyway, that's that part, the trivializing via allurements. And it is alluring. Jazz is the kind of music that's very alluring.
Our complaint today wouldn't be jazz. Our complaint today would probably be hip hop.
Well, that's real. That's obviously, you know, yeah. I mean, people would defend jazz, quite a lot, but who would defend hip hop? Gah.
Somebody probably would.
Yeah, but not people who are serious. Not serious white people.
Right-minded people would not defend
right.
such.
That's right. That's right. Right-minded. Like me. Okay, and the last one is sowing seeds of disruption through economic theories. We've talked about that a lot. And
the means by which the Jews secure their power.
Yes, and what they want. I mean, they want financial control. They want political control. They want control over education. They want to trivialize our minds, and they want to disrupt our nations and our societies and communities with all these ideas. And of course, it talks a lot about economic theories, which they say in the protocols, they say we present these as something more solid than they are, you know, as something that really works when they're just theories, and ideas and so on. So, the International Jew says the protocols are for setting up the most drastic The International Jew says the protocols, the protocols are. See, well, the thing about the protocols is that they admit that they're doing this to fool the people, you know, the Gentile people. They admit that they're trying to put something over on us, and what they're trying to put over on us is to create the most drastic and irresponsible liberalism in government. That's what the International Jew is saying. But they don't want that once they take over. You see, once the whole idea of the protocols is that we're doing this now to the Gentiles until we take over. And when we take over, you know, we're weakening everything that they're doing. And when we take over, well, we will have it totally different. They don't want anything like this in their government. They're going to have a very strict one-man rule, and everybody's going to think he's just the greatest thing that ever happened. Nobody will even question him or anything, and yeah. This is the way it will be for us at that mm-hmm. time. So this is what they're trying to get hold
of. Yeah,
that's
the part I don't believe.
Yeah, well, we can talk about that now or later, but why don't you believe... Oh. I know you don't believe that. That's what the Jews are trying to do.
No, they don't want it. They don't want a Jewish autocrat. And actually, in the early history of the Soviet Union, I mean, from what I've read, they actually did screw things up pretty much. You know, the word Soviet means council. It means so. The Soviet system is a rule by councils. It's a kind of a pseudo democracy, really. And there really wasn't anybody that was the autocrat. And still in the Soviet Union until Stalin. And once that happened, it was the beginning of the curtailment of Jewish power.
Yeah, I know you use that as though that explains everything. But I don't know that that explains
an autocrat is not what they want. They want a certain amount of chaos is what they want.
Well, there are Jews who have used that word autocrat in their writings, and they say that that's what they want.
Who said that?
They talked about an autocrat. Well, it came up, I think, even last week in something. I can't quote it right now, but it was used in Adolf Kremieux here's one example in that Mizraim Lodge in Paris in the 1800s. It was founded in 1805 in Italy, and then it moved into France, and it was real high-level Freemasonry. That was the one I talked about, 90 degrees and all that. And where this, as the story goes, is Joseph Schorst, who took the protocol documents from that lodge in 1884, Kremieux died in 1880, and then things were not quite as tight around there, and he took that from there, this is the way the story goes, and sold it, or gave it to that Russian woman for 2,500, whatever they used at that time. Anyway, it was a lot of money for that time, And then he went to, then in the next year, in a short time, within that year, he was found dead in Egypt. So he went to Egypt, but they found him and killed him. Well, the fact that he was found dead in Egypt at that time is true, for sure. This lodge had a policy of the head of it being considered an autocrat. He didn't have to convene with anybody about anything, and they believed in an autocrat.
That's Freemasonry.
Very Jewish. Well, what do you think all this stuff is? What if the protocols is all about Freemasonry?
No.
So what do you think? Freemasonry is not Jewish?
Yes and no, but still, what goes on within Freemasonry is not the same as what Freemasonry itself even advocates for society as a whole. One of the main points of Freemasonry is that every society should be a democratic republic.
Well, see, they push this democracy and republic. I mean, that's all explained in the protocols if you would read it. I mean, that's a whole big farce, the whole thing about democratic republic.
But that's my point. That's that democratic republic is a kind of system that is most easily manipulated through organized pressure. And it has the advantage.
That's what they're pushing on us now.
You're going to keep talking over me.
Yeah, because that's what they're pushing on us. But when they take power, it's not going to be that way. It's not going to be a democratic republic. See, there's a difference.
They already have their power now. As a small minority of people, if the Jews try to overtly act as a tyranny, they're in big trouble because they're just a small minority of people.
You know what? They're not in big trouble. And you know who's in trouble? And this is something that I'm starting to catch on to real good. Who's in trouble is us. And for us to talk about them being
in trouble, mainly because we don't realize what's going on. Because the whole thing is disguised through this big game called the Democratic Republic.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that. You know, it's just where it's going to end up, I guess, is where we disagree. Well, okay, where was I? If you're done with that, I'll go on with this little intro, this little summary of what they were talking about. That's good, though, because this is what we're going to do in this program today. We're going to discuss some of these things in more depth. So, and I will try not to talk over you, but I thought I needed to say that. Said that they want irresponsible liberalism in government, and they talk about the super government that has unchallenged influence over all other governments, which is already in place in 19, whenever this was supposed to be, you know, 1890s or something when this was written. We will discuss that a little bit more, too, when we get to it. They mentioned that during the recent war years, I'm talking about the International Jew is saying that during the recent war years, we have seen an almost complete Judaized administration in control of all the war activities of the American people. Of course, the World War One time. They say that the Jewish men who were chosen were competent men, but asked the question, were there no non-Jews who were also competent? Because it was almost all Jews who were in control of these war activities, programs and bureaucracies that were created, the war administration and so on. And then they say the selection and control of presidents, as outlined in the 10th protocol, is of great importance. You know, they talked about that quite a bit. It is with something of a shock, I'm quoting now from the book, that one reads that men with a past are especially favored for the presidential office. Men with a past have become president in various countries, including the United States. There's no doubt of that. And then this quote from Protocol 10, we will manipulate the election of presidents whose past contains some undisclosed dark affair, some Panama. Then they will be faithful executors of our orders from fear of exposure and from the natural desire of every man who has attained a position of authority to retain the privileges, emoluments, and the dignity associated with the position of president. We talked a little bit about that Panama thing last week, and I'm going to have to go into that some more because that does change for me what I can say about when this thing, when these protocols could have been written. But also, I really like this sentence about the natural desire of every man or everyone who has attained a position of authority wants to retain that, particularly when we think of the American president or any president of any European nation or whatever. You know, once, or others, once you, you know, look at all the privileges they have and how everything is there for them and anything they want and how they're treated with such, such reverence, you know, and so with such, well, you know, when they enter into any kind of a place, you know, they're, band is playing or whatever, or they go anywhere, the band is playing and people are looking up to them and they're given all sorts of, respect, just based on the office that they hold. And, you know, when you experience that, just think of Obama now and all that is done for him and he can have do anything he wants. You experience that for 4 or 8 years. It's kind of hard to give up, and you would want to keep that. I mean, anybody would like to hold on to that. It'd be a little bit difficult, quite a change to go from that to just back to being just an ordinary person, right? So they use that. They use that, you know, to these people. They want to keep their position, and so they'll do things for it, and also their past, you know, they find people who have some problem in the closet that they can use to blackmail them. And then it talks about Theodore Herzl's, he used the expression Panama in his book, The Judenstaat, Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state. And that came out in 1895, and it was published. It was published in 1896, excuse me, to immediate acclaim and controversy. In the book, he outlines the reasons for the Jewish people who so desire to leave Europe and so on. And the international Jew says he uses the expression Panama, speaking of the management of the business of Palestine. Herzl wrote in that book that the Society of the Jews will see to it that the enterprise does not become a Panama, but a Suez. Right. And they think that, you explained that last week, that Suez was a real good project and the Panama was fraught with scandal and financial scandals and so on. And
bad
that
planning anyway.
In Wikipedia, they say
the key point there is probably that it ended in failure.
Well, in Wikipedia, they say that there was, it came out in the 90s that there was this, 91, that there was this, mishandling of money and it was, some people were responsible for it. So it wasn't just, you know, it was more than that. At least, I don't know if that was just made up or what, but that's what they say there. And anyway, the International Jew says that this expression should occur in Herzl and in the protocols is significant.
It might be, but you see, the thing is that expression could have been pretty widespread before either of them used it. It could have been something.
Well,
like
that's what I've said about some things between the protocols and Jolie's dialogues in Hell. So, you know, you can always, that's it. You can't be sure if somebody took something from somewhere.
There's a difference between a passage being plagiarized and, you know, and just a metaphor that might be in popular usage. That's not really a valid comparison.
Yes. Okay. And in America... Oh, then they said that talking about these scandals, they said that in America, a scandal involving a woman is more serious than in Europe, where mishandling money is the more serious matter, because love affairs with women and so on doesn't bother the Europeans But it still bothers Americans a lot. So they made that point. And that's where we ended. And I'll just say that another thing that was in that first part that came up between you and I don't know if we want to talk more about this or not. In that protocol, one of the protocols that they quoted, this claim is made that de facto we have already eliminated every government except our own. This is the protocol guy speaking.
Yeah, that was definitely not true.
We are not. There are still many others left. And yeah, you disagree with that. But you know, all it is, it doesn't matter because you've got. If Jews are writing this, they're just boasting about that. It doesn't have to be true, but it has to be what they want to say. What they're saying.
I think Jews are highly conscious that the Tsar's government was not their government.
They say that they're in control. They already knew that they had what it took to do that. They have a lot of confidence in themselves, I think. They had that all prepared. I think it's a lot of bragging. You know, they say we have eliminated every government, in fact, even though not legally we haven't, but we're still, because they go on to talk about all their agents and so on, where there's a lot of truth in that. So,
it's a gross overstatement.
Well, they do a lot of that. I don't know if it's an overstatement though. Now we talked about that Montefiore quote and, I couldn't find anything on that. So, I think that's too bad that they would put that in there. And maybe it was passing around at the time, and it's possible that he would say that, but he would never say it in a way that it would get out to the non-Jewish public.
Yeah, if anybody knows the source of the quotes attributed to Moses Montefiore, you can post them in the comments section there.
Yeah, right. We'd like to know, but I think that's just one of those things that gets like that Ben Franklin.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's false.
Yeah, it's one of those false things because that just doesn't sound like him. Even though he's a Jew and he was all for the Jews, he wasn't somebody who would quite talk that way, I don't think, unless he was really in a secret place. So, but if they can't say where it's from, it's not any good. Here's a little point that I had written down, and I don't know why. All copies that were known to exist in Russia were destroyed in the Kerensky regime. We're talking now about the protocols that Nilus wrote, you know, that first book he put out. And that once the Kerensky regime came to power in 1917, all the copies of that were known to exist in Russia were destroyed. And under Kerensky's successors, the possession of a copy by anyone in Soviet land was a crime sufficient to ensure the owner of being shot on sight. Where did those copies come from then that we have? Were they all sent out of Russia before that, or were some of them not found by the new Soviet regime or what? But anyway... they say, whoever said this, said this fact alone is sufficient to proof of the genuineness of the protocols. But I said, no, it really isn't because they could have been after that, those protocols because it was defamation of Jews, not because they knew that it was authentic. Right?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be true necessarily to be damaging.
Right. And that's a good point because they are damaging. And this question of just how true they are that you bring up and other people bring up may not be as important as the fact that if people know about them, they're very damaging. And the Jews knew they were damaging. So they didn't want any of that. And when they couldn't stop it, when they got out into Europe and so on, then they took a different tack of just.
Yeah, problem is that if the protocols have there's been enough propagation of the message that the protocols are not authentic, that it's really not damaging to them at this point. At this point, it does more damage to the person that waves it around than to the Jews.
I know you've said that before, and I'm glad you brought it up now because I totally disagree with that. I don't think it damages those of us who wave it around, and they still are afraid of it. They still don't want it around, and they don't look forward to people coming up with it. I don't think you're right that it has been so it is so accepted by everyone that it's a forgery. No more than everything about the Jews is accepted by most people as being anti-Semitic or something like that. This is true of everything. You know, people don't want to look at the issues. And this is what I'm going to bring out in tonight's program, that I think that we are failing in our mission, in our need to bring out these issues and use the excellent material of the protocols in doing that. Yeah. Well, I'm really going far away from your position. So let's go on here. okay, we're now ready. That's all I had. Now ready for you to start reading.
Okay, so they were talking about people having scandals in their past, and he says that in Europe, having an illicit affair with a woman is not quite the scandal that it is in the USA.
Right.
And so Europeans usually have some different kind of scandal in their past. The whole subject is extremely distasteful, but truth has its surgical duties to perform. And this is one of them. When, for example, a pivotal assemblage like that of the peace conference is studied, and the men who are most subject to Jewish influence are isolated, and their past history is carefully traced, there is almost no difficulty whatever in determining the precise moment when they passed over into that fateful condition which, while it did not hinder them of public honors for 1 hour, made them unchangeably the servants of a power the public did not see. The puzzling spectacle which the observer sees of the great leaders of Anglo-Saxon races closely surrounded and continuously counseled by the princes of the Semitic race is explained only by a knowledge of those leaders' past and those words of the protocols. We will manipulate the election of presidents whose past contains some undisclosed dark affair. And where this...
let's not go by this too quickly, although I shouldn't break in too much because we will run out of time. But, you know, it is a puzzling. It is. How do we explain? How does anybody explain how the great leaders of the Anglo-Saxon races... I have for so long, well, certainly since during World War I and even before that, been so closely surrounded and continuously counseled by what they call the princes, or these, you know, important members of the Semitic race or the Jewish race. Why are they counseled by Jews? How is that explained? But nobody even asked for the explanation. Right?
Yeah.
We should be.
Well, the Jews are such clever people.
Yeah, well, that's what it's going to say here as we
go on.
They're
the ones that know everything.
But you see, that they don't, but that is what they say. That is what they put across. Oh, we're too dumb. You know, that just falls right into the Jewish plan in the protocols. You know, we're the dumb goyim, and we don't know anything. And they're so, you know, that's why we're no match for them. And the fact is, throughout history, we haven't been a match for them. We've had this great majority of starting out of power and land owning and pop, you know, our numbers and so on, and we've continued to lose ground.
Well, that's more to do with disunity and naivete than actually.
Oh, it has to do with, well, all of that. But you know what's, that's not an explanation for it. I mean, that's not an excuse for it. I'm very concerned about that, about where we are today, how far gone we are.
We have to stop being disunited and naive, that's all.
Well, that's true, but, you know, that's not on the horizon. Well, continue.
Don't be so trusting. And where this Jewish domination of officials is glaringly apparent, it may be safely assumed that the custody of the secret is almost entirely with that race. When necessity arises, it may be a public service for those in possession of the facts to make them public. Not for the purpose of destroying reputations, but for the purpose of damning, for all time, a most cowardly practice. Politically, so the Jewish publicists tell us, Jews do not vote as a group. Because of this, so we are told, they have no political influence. Moreover, we are told, they are so divided among themselves that they cannot be led in one direction. It may be true that when it is a question of being for anything, the Jewish community may show a majority and minority opinion. A small minority, it is likely to be. But when it becomes a question of being against anything, the Jewish community is always a unit. These are facts to which any ward politician can testify. Any man in political life can test it for himself by announcing that he will not permit himself to be not dominated by Jews or anybody else. Just let him mention Jews in that manner. He will no longer have to read about Jewish solidarity. He will have felt it. Not that, in a vote, this Jewish solidarity can accomplish anything it wishes. The Jew's political strength is not in his vote, but in the pull of, say, seven men at the seat of government. The Jews, a political minority so far as votes are concerned, were a political majority so far as influence was concerned during the last 5 years. They ruled. They boast that they ruled. The mark of their rule is everywhere.
Well, that's pretty strong language, isn't it?
Talking about during the period of the First World War there.
That's right. That's right. The war period. And they're very adamant in the international Jew that the Jews were in control of all that, you know, and that's why they also had control at the peace conference at the end. And this idea that we still now talk about the Jewish vote. Oh, the Jewish vote is democratic. The Jewish vote is this or that. You know, it's not the Jewish vote. It's the Jewish money in the political process. And that's equivalent to the, what is saying, the men who are pushing the, you know, pushing the person to do what they want them to do.
Well, you know, the difference between voting Democrat and Republican is like voting for the Israeli Likud or the Israeli Labor Party. That's what it amounts to.
Right.
Because both parties are Zionist.
But, you know, they talk about voting all the time, you know, as well you are. And as, you know, we agree that it's not about the votes. It's about the money.
This was dramatized at both conventions. Both conventions had rigged voice votes. You know, at the Republican convention, they had that rules change to try to keep the Ron Paul people from influencing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the Democratic convention, they had the voice vote on changing their platform to, I think it was to put Jerusalem as the capital of Israel back into it, something like that. Mm-hmm. And this was, the voice votes obviously went against both of those motions, but they both were said to have passed. It was blatant. So both.
Yeah, I was a delegate at a Democratic convention. Well, that was that one between Kerry and Bush, and I experienced that there. They did that where there was something that I was, you know, a lot of us were concerned about, and they did that voice vote thing, and there was all kinds of complaints about it. But you know, there's nothing you can do. They just push it through.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you join a different party, I guess. Well, you only have two choices, and they both seem to be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
The note which everyone observes in politics, as in the press, is the fear of the Jews. This fear is such that nowhere are the Jews discussed as are, say, the Armenians, the Germans, the Russians, or the Hindus. What is this fear but reflection of the knowledge of the Jews' power and their ruthlessness in the use of it? It is possibly true, as many Jewish publicists say, that what is called anti-Semitism is just a panic fear. It is a dread of the unknown. The uncanny spectacle of an apparently poor people who are richer than all, of a very small minority which is more powerful than all, creates phantoms before the mind. It is very significant that those who most assume to represent the Jews are quite content that the fear should exist. They wish it to exist. To keep it delicately poised and always there, though not too obtrusively, is an art they practice. But once the balance is threatened, their crudeness instantly appears. Then comes the threat, by which it is hoped to reestablish the fear again. When the threat fails, there comes the wail of anti-Semitism.
Well, so they use anti-Semitism. They want it, and they want us to fear them. They do. They think that's just great. But they don't admit it.
Yeah, well, what he's implying there is that it's actually useful to defy the Jews, even if you know that you won't get your way in the end, because it forces them to drop their mask.
Yeah, that's good. I absolutely think we need to defy the Jews.
How strange this is, that the Jews should not see that the most abject form of anti-Semitism is just this fear, which they are willing to have felt toward them by their neighbors. This fear is Semitophobia in its worst form. To inspire fear, what is more dreaded by the normal man, and yet what more delights an inferior race? Now, a great service is done when the people are emancipated from this fear. It is the process of emancipation that Jewish publicists attack. It is this they call anti-Semitism. It is not anti-Semitism at all. It is the only course that can prevent anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. The process involves several steps. The extent of the Jewish power must be shown. To this, of course, strong Jewish objection is made, though no strong disproof can be made.
Then there we go. This is real good. See, now they're laying it out here. To get rid of this fear of the Jews, which is what anti-Semitism is, they say, because people react to this people that they fear and don't like what they're doing and don't like to have to be afraid of them. So he's saying the extent what to do about it is to make the Jewish power shown. And that's what they think the protocols will do. And I think so, too. I think the protocols do it better than anything else. But anyway, that's a part of the way of showing to the people, showing to our people, what Jewish power looks like and how it behaves and how.
Well, the problem with using the protocols to do that is that the source is unknown and impossible to demonstrate. So therefore, it does not have any.
It doesn't matter what the source is, really, because it's how people can see it all around them. I've been reading the protocols.
But if you can see it all around you, then you don't need the protocols.
Oh, yes, you do, because people are in denial and they don't recognize it. But if it's pointed out the way the protocols does, and if the protocols were offered to the people with help, you know, because it's hard to read the protocols. If some of the sentences are so long, and it's in language, you know, from a time back. It's, you know, it'd have to be, but I don't think it should be rewritten in modern language. I think it should, you know, they should just get a help in understanding what's being said in it. And then when they see all that, I mean, it's just, when you read all of it, it's hard to do because it's just tiresome, reading it, tiring. But, you know, if you can get at enough of it, it's overwhelming in what you say, my God, you know, this is all exactly what's happening. And it's very powerful.
Not exactly.
But, yeah, okay. Well, that was the point I wanted to make. So you can go on now. Thank you.
Then the existence of this power must be explained. It can be explained only by the Jewish will to power, as it may be called, or by the deliberate program which is followed in the attainment of the power. When the method is explained, half the damage is undone. The Jew is not a superman. He is bright. He is intense. His philosophy of material things leaves him free to do many things from which his neighbor draws back. But, given equal advantages, he is not a Superman. The Yankee is more than his equal any time, but the Yankee has an inborn inclination to observe the rules of the game. When the people know by what means this power is gained, when they are informed how, for example, political control is seized, as it has been in the United States, the very method takes all the glamour from the power and shows it to be a rather sordid thing after all. This series of articles is attempting to take these orderly steps, and it is believed the complete effort will justify itself to reasonable minds, both Jewish and Gentile. In the present article, one important means of power has been described on the authority of the protocols. Whether the method laid down by the protocols is worth considering or not depends entirely on whether it can be found in actual affairs today. It can be found. The two tally. The parallel is complete. It were well for the Jew, of course, if no trace of him could be found in either the written or the actual program. But he is there, and it is illogical for him to blame anyone but himself for being there. Certainly, it is small defense against the fact to heap abuse upon the one who discloses the fact. We have agreed that the Jews are clever, but they are not so clever as to be able to cover their work. There is a certain element of weakness in them which reveals the whole matter in the end. And even the revelation would not mean much if the thing revealed were not wrong. But that is the weakness of the Jewish program. It is wrong. The Jews have never gained any measure of success so great that the world cannot check it. The world is engaged in a great checking tactic now, and if there are still prophets among the Jews, they should lead their people in another path.
You know, they're saying there, because they believe that because these protocols have come out, this is still 1920, we don't have that London Times article yet, and everybody is talking about it, everybody, you know, lots of people are reading it, so they say now this great checking tactic is going on now, and they had great hopes for educating people about what was in there, what it meant, and so on. But it didn't pan out that way. Because most people were quick to jump on the forgery bandwagon and say, oh, okay, well, forget this.
Yeah, you know, I'm driving that bandwagon, by the way.
Yeah, I know. But that's how weak we are in the face of using, when we get the very good stuff to use, we're able to be turned away from it by this cleverness of the Jews that he thinks they're not that clever. Well, they have all these friends. They have all these non-Jewish friends who help them do it. That's true. And they talk about that a lot in the protocols, all their agents and all their goyim who work for them and so on. And it's absolutely correct. Well, anyway. Oh, we're almost done here.
Okay. The proof and the fruit of any exposure of the world program is the removal of the element of fear from the peoples among whom the Jews live.
Okay, so they're hoping that they're going to expose this world program with the International Jew, and they, you know, I've already talked quite a bit about the protocols, and but they don't continue. You know what they're going to do, in because we're. On next chapter is 19 and then 20, and then we're going to go to, I think we're going to start on things about the United States. And then they think they can get people to wake up to what the Jews were doing. But we have to ask ourselves, we will be asking ourselves, why didn't that work? Why didn't we? And, you know, I just see a whole lot of failure on the part of, you know, our people, even though you had people like Henry Ford putting out so much to wake everybody up and give them what they needed to know. But in the end, where are we today? We're much worse off. And you think that these protocols should be thrown in the trash can.
Well, not necessarily in the trash can, but it's not something that the people should be presenting as authentic, because we know that it's not. And that's a large part of the reason, I think, for why this educational effort had less effect than it might have had, is because it featured so heavily this document that is demonstrably fraudulent.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people, an awful lot of people who think that, you know, who don't see that whether it's, what did you call it, authentic or not, is very important at all. And that we can tell that it's authentic. We can tell that it's genuinely a Jewish program by seeing how the program has panned out. And
well,
they
sure.
saw it
if,
already
if,
then. And now we see it even better now. And I tell you, if you would read those protocols the way I've been reading them, I mean, it's just, it is such a slam dunk case. It's so good. There's areas in there. In fact, I had a whole lot of them. I have some of them written down. If we have time, I might. What did I do? My pages are turned backwards. I don't have the right page.
It's been a lot better if...
what did I do? Oh, here they are.
Protocols haven't been featured so heavily in the International Jew.
Well, I don't think so.
I've
learned about it in a way that I would not have, and I think I've learned a whole lot, and I'm very appreciative. So, see, we just see it differently.
Instead of talking about the protocols, he should have talked more about the documentable facts to which the protocols call attention.
The protocols has documentable facts.
Jewish activities in politics and Jewish activities in mass media and so forth, and not refer to the protocols and not say on the authority of the protocols, because the protocols have no authority.
Well, that's your opinion. I'm looking to see if there's any emails from listeners. Nothing, but listeners, if you want to, you can call, or if you want to say something about this, you can send an email. Well, I'll keep my email on so I see it if something shows up. Now, one thing I noticed in the reading that I've been doing the last few days, since my computer was gone, listeners, since Tuesday morning, I wouldn't turn on, so I had to take it into the shop, and I had them do a lot of scanning for viruses, which turned out I didn't have any, but I was without it for 2.5 days, so I was enforced to do without the internet, so I got some good reading done, and, one thing that they point out, quite fairly often, is that they are in control, and they are so much in control that we can never get it back again. That we, they point this out in different ways. Like here in Protocol 5, they say, and this I think we need to pay attention to, they say, for a time we might be successfully dealt with by a coalition of the goyim of all the world. Now, just imagine that this is supposedly a leader who's talking to a group of elite Jews, like in a Freemasonry meeting or a lodge meeting or in some kind of special meeting, or I don't think it would be in an open place like one of those, what are we talking about, the congresses or anything like that. I don't think they'd ever say these things there. He says that it could, we might, the goyim could, they always say goyim in here, they could form a coalition and come after us, but from this danger we are secured by the discord existing among them. Just what you said, Hattie, and we all know, whose roots are so deeply seated that they can never now be plucked up. And they say, we have set one against another the personal and national reckonings of the goyim, religious and race hatreds, and boy, the religious is still today, and that's one, well, I'm going to get into that in a second, which we have fastened into a huge growth in the course of the past 20 centuries. It says there, then it goes on a little bit later to say, there is not one state which would receive support if it were to raise its arm, meaning against us, Any agreement against us would be unprofitable to itself. We are too strong. There is no evading our power. And, of course, they often mention that they have the power of the gold already. They own all the money in the world. And they did already then when they were right. When this is, let's say, you know, in the 1890s. The nations cannot come to even an inconsiderable private agreement without our secretly having a hand in it, meaning that they're present in every government and everything that goes on amongst the goyim. You know, they have their agents and their people there. And they say, well, here's this final. All the wheels of the machinery of all states go by the force of the engine in our hands. That engine is gold. Well, now, to get to the religious thing, I wanted to bring this up with you. And in all good friendship and so on, but I think that here's my theory, Hanning, that you and William Pierce and maybe Will Williams and whoever else amongst your people who think the way you do, you dislike Christianity, and the protocols are most popular with Christian people because it's kind of like the Antichrist and all that, and they all go for it. And I think that you don't like the aspect that that it puts down. You know, you believe in science and reason, and this is what the Jews are saying they're using against us to get rid of our faith-based, to get rid of our Christianity, to get rid of all this kind of thing. Yeah, well, that is, but they're still doing that. And you take the opposite position that you say, oh, they're not really doing that. They really like Christianity because it belongs to them and they created it. And, burning the white people. See, it's just a totally different approach. And that's why you don't like people.
Well, some
like
people don't have like this conspiracy theory that the Jews created Christianity to subjugate non-Jews. Nietzsche, in fact, is one of the people that wrote that, actually, in his
book.
You know,
Nietzsche is another one who I don't like very much, and he's someone who's so promoted by the people who would hate the protocols.
He wrote that in The Antichrist, and I think also in the Toward a Genealogy of Morals. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche wrote that. So it would be strange that the Jews would be promoting Nietzsche. But I don't necessarily believe that. I don't think there's really enough clear evidence about it. Seems possible. But I don't think that European Christianity, for most of its history, was controlled by Jews. This premillennialist Christianity that's so widespread in the United States today seems to be very much under the influence of Jews.
Well, yeah, they're the ones who created what has become Christian Zionism. What's that Bible? I was trying to think of it today, and I didn't look it up, and I can't. People know what it is. It's this most
Scofield.
Yeah, Scofield. Thank you. I knew you'd know. The Scofield Bible. They paid for whoever wrote that. They funded that, and that is all a rewriting so that showing the Jews the way they want to be shown. That's not Christianity, and most people are aware of that. But that's what Christian Zionism.
I'm sure most people are aware of that. I think a lot of people are not aware of this kind of thing at all.
Well, but people who are Christians are aware of it.
I think the overlap between Christians and belief in the protocol is a matter of the inclination to just believe something that you found written in a book.
No, it isn't that, Hattie. It's different than that. The protocols are really point out again and again that the desire is to destroy by those people who are speaking in the protocols to destroy all traditional forms of life, you know, amongst the European peoples, and that certainly includes their Christianity, their churches, and also monarchies too, and rulers and kings and so on, which are not looked upon badly by that's what they're going to enforce once they take over completely. They always say, once we come into our power, and they'll say, once the day comes when we have everything in place and we take it all over, then they will institute their one, you know, king of the, from the throne of David, and it will be like an autocrat.
That would be suicidal for them to do that, because
it wouldn't be, and not if they had control of everything by then. It wouldn't be. And they said somewhere else that that I wrote down. Here it is. There should be in all the states of the world, besides ourselves, only the masses of the proletariat, a few millionaires devoted to our interests, police and soldiers. Isn't that where we're? Well, you hear that all the time today. That's what's happening in the world. And they want to say it's the globalists. Oh, it's the, you know, it's a corporate people or something. Well, it's the Jews.
Well, yeah, sure.
Or it's the globalists.
Jews. I'm not, yeah. Nobody says that a large part of what is said in the protocols is not true. A large part of it is true. But that doesn't mean that everything in it is true. And it doesn't mean that it's an authentic document. And
you know what? Everything is true.
You shouldn't be citing it as a source. You shouldn't be citing it.
It doesn't matter if everything is true, because it's the Jews talking about what they're doing and what you know, and how it's going to turn out. So it might not turn out exactly that way, along exactly everything, but it's in general it is, and that's good enough. And the fact of this authenticity is just what do you call a thing that's just a straw man or something, or it's a red herring, or it's something that doesn't matter. It's always brought up this authenticity business.
Well, it does matter.
Because
basically, it's an what the protocols amount to are a prolonged anonymous tip.
You know, you don't know who wrote them.
That's
nobody,
right. Nobody.
Well, okay, that's the problem. Nobody can say who wrote them, whether it was Jews or anti-Jews.
You can't cite it as proof of anything. You have to follow up.
We're not citing it as proof of anything. We're citing it as a plan that's been put forth here that shows that it was actually been carried out, and to our detriment. And if we don't care about what's to our detriment, you know, and this is how they get around it, by always causing question about things like authenticity or the veracity or whether something is good or not. Then we're supposed to ignore it. And when we do that, oh, here we are. We really go according to their will. We're really doing what they want us to do.
No, you have to look. When you get an anonymous tip on it, on anything, you have to follow up on it, get some facts. Then once you have the facts, you can cite your facts, not the anonymous.
I think we do have the facts on it.
Then don't cite your anonymous tip as proof of anything. You use your facts.
You use that. We're using that not as proof, but we're using it as the plan that will make people.
Yeah, but there
if we can get people to read that, and maybe with some help, you know, some commentary or something or whatever, they would be amazed. I believe they would be amazed, but they're not reading it.
There are some things in this anonymous tip called the protocols that are not accurate.
Oh, big deal. Big deal. Well, Hattie, thank you very much for this great program tonight, and we're going off the air. I don't hear the music, but I think it's playing. Oh, here it comes. Okay, next week, ladies and gentlemen, chapter 19, the All-Jewish Mark on Red Russia.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.